We're starting today with Major League Baseball and the report last night from Jeff Passan of ESPN that the league and the owners are expected within a week's time to make a proposal to the Players Association that would put in motion the ability for the league to get underway this coming season. That is a big deal. Let's just take a step back momentarily here and understand that this is getting very real very quickly. And that's a good thing. If you're a fan, if you're me, you're excited about this. You think, okay, baseball's coming back. We're going to have Major League Baseball at some point in the near future. Now, it is also important to note that there are 1 to 2 million things that need to be cleared first. Obvious hyperbole there, but there are still a lot of hurdles that Major League Baseball, ownership, the players, everybody involved have to clear first before we can actually get underway. But this is the closest we've gotten to a sports league returning here in the United States. We're still waiting on the NBA. There are teams in the NBA who are straight up saying, yeah, we don't really think we need to open up our facilities. We don't really care. We'll just wait. Head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, Frank Vogel, he just said that yesterday. Said, you know what? Well, if other teams are opening now, that's fine. We're not going to. Whatever. Steve Kerr of the Golden State Warriors pretty much said, yeah, we're going to finish with the worst record in the league anyway. We don't care. The NHL still trying to figure anything out to continue its season, but Major League Baseball has thoughts here. And it actually lines up accurately or similarly to what former Major Leaguer Trevor Plouffe said on Twitter earlier this week. And we brought it up at the time and just thought, okay, well, this is optimistic. That's good. Optimism is a positive thing, but sort of dismissed it because I don't know of any other time Trevor Plouffe has ever broken news. I don't know how many veteran, retired middle infielders have great sources within the industry. But this proposal that's being reported by Jeff Passan does mirror some of the things that were outlined by Plouffe earlier in the week. Part of the report over on ESPN.com, and you can read the entire thing there, a lot of detail from Jeff Passan, but the way he explains it, in part, Major League Baseball expects to offer a return-to-play proposal to the MLB Players Association within a week as teams have begun to encourage players to prepare for a spring training, spring in air quotes, that could begin in mid-June and a season that could start in early July. Although a significant number of hurdles remain and some industry leaders believe June and July return dates are overly optimistic, ownership's approval of a plan and dialogue about specifics with the union would mark two vital steps toward baseball's return from a season so far delayed by 6 weeks. June and July being optimistic in and of itself is a little bit unfortunate to hear just because I think it's already felt like so long. The Big 12 tournament was canceled back on March 12th. We haven't had a sporting event in these parts ever since. No professional sporting events, no college sporting events, none of that. And now as we hit a full week into the month of May here on May 7th, it feels like it's been forever, even though it's only been 2 months. And obviously, there are other factors that play into that as well. It's not just the sports world being completely shut down. Stay-at-home orders all over the country, including here in our own state. There are a lot of different factors that play into it feeling like the days are going by like they're 48 hours long as opposed to 24 hours long. But this is a positive sign nonetheless. Even though it feels like, God, mid-June, that's still almost a month and a half away. How could you need that much time? Oh my gosh, July, 2 months to early July. How could you need that much time? And I get it. I totally understand that. Even though I generally view these things with as much caution as possible because I want everyone to be safe. I want to make sure we can get these things that we love back and don't have to shut them down so quickly again. I think it's fair to think that's a long time from now. We should be able to get these things done. We should be able to get them ramped up again by the middle of June and by early July to start the season. But even if that feels like a long time, even if the league itself feels like those are overly optimistic dates, this is a huge positive for baseball fans and for sports fans in general. Now, some of the important things from Jeff Passan's report include this passage, and I'll read it as a full quote. Already, dozens of players are working out at team facilities around the country, according to sources, and the possibility of holding a 3 or 4 week spring training at teams' home stadiums appeals to a number of stakeholders. After entertaining the idea of quarantining all players in Arizona or using 3 or 5 city hubs to hold games, there is momentum toward the league trying to play games in home stadiums. This is the best alternative. Obviously, everything is an alternative now because we're not getting a real, normal, full season. But this is the best option as far as I can see it. Yes, the Arizona plan makes some sense in that you don't have anywhere to go. There are fewer things you can do where you can possibly become infected with COVID-19. There are less places you can go that are dangerous. You're very much self-contained. The biodome, if you will. But that's such a hassle in so many ways. First, you have to make sure there's the infrastructure there to house all of these players and media and the team personnel and all of that who are going to be down there covering this. That's a tough thing to do. Also, we've covered this plenty of times. It is extremely hard to tell grown adults, hey, for the next 4 months, you can't see your family. Your wife? Sorry, can't see them. Your siblings, your parents, sorry. Your children, sorry. That's a tough thing to do. That is a really hard thing. And since they have to get an agreement between ownership and the players, you can see how very easily the players would say, no, absolutely not. We're not going to do that. We're not going to completely abandon everyone we know and everything we know for a few months like that. And granted, I understand that to most of us, seems like champagne problems. You're making millions of dollars. You either play or you don't get paid. So why wouldn't you do that? I understand that. I really do get that viewpoint. But from the player's perspective, this is work. And you want to be able to go home after a long day at work and see your wife or see your kids or whatever it might be. So by playing at home stadiums and having your quasi spring training round 2 at your home stadiums, you are making it far more appealing to the players. That is a big bonus and a big draw, I think, for the Players Association to say, okay, there are risks here, but we'll get paid and we'll get to be at home. We'll get to be at our home parks. We don't have to play in spring training parks in Arizona heat for the entire baseball season, the entire summer. God, can you imagine August baseball outdoors at 2 o'clock in Arizona? That's hell. That's terrible. No one would ever want to do that.
No, exactly. And although it does beat the humidity that Kansas City weather does get, but this has been the best plan that I think and most logical plan to be put out there by a professional league. And you are right. At a time like this, where our world is at, I think it would be selfish to have to ask players to leave their family for months on end, because that's their life too. That's a part of their life too. And right now, the world is going through something serious, and definitely being away from family members for so long is something that you wouldn't want to ask. But as far as the baseball part of it, I like the idea of spring training at home stadiums. I like the idea that you're going to give them close to a month to where they can get back into baseball shape. My only thought is there's two Royals stuck in Arizona right now, and one of them's your starting pitcher, your number one go.
Yeah, we discussed that the other day. Brad Keller and it's Nicky Lopez who are the two down there, and they're just working out.
Would they be able to get back? And I would think so.
Yeah, I would figure they'd find a way. And travel has been one of the big issues for all of these plans for all sorts of sports. You know, how are you going to travel? How are you going to do all of these different things? But I still feel like this, and this is put out there by Jeff Passan as well. I just mentioned it's still easier to do this and figure these things out than to put together the logistics of putting thousands of people in a small, again, biosphere, biodome environment in the middle of Arizona, in the Phoenix area. There are so many logistical things that you would need to work out and that you'd frankly have to stress over. And you sort of have to weigh that, if you're the league and you're the players, with the risks of playing in your home cities. I mean, consider the Mets, consider the Yankees. New York, we know, has been hit by this virus more intensely than any other state in the country. There are some states that have been hit extremely intensely. But do you weigh making sure they're contained and they can go nowhere but home and the park and the facility, Or do you just kind of cram them all in Arizona and hope for the best? And, you know, if something did happen there, frankly, you've got someone who's infected in a much smaller area that's much more dense as opposed to spread out across, what would that be, 28 cities or approximately 27 cities if you count Anaheim and LA the same, which I'm sure they wouldn't like me doing, but you get the gist, two teams that are marketed as LA. So you've got to weigh the pros and cons of each plan, but to me, if the league wants the players to agree to it, it is much easier to bring them along and say, you can play at home. Royals, you can play at Kauffman Stadium, and you'll do your summer training, if you will, at Kauffman Stadium. You don't have to go back down to Surprise and then travel back. No, you're just going to do it all at the K. The Cubs, you can play at Wrigley. The Twins, you can play at Target Field. It's just so much easier that way. Now, that's not the only thing that baseball needs to figure out here. And Passan outlines that there are other things between the players and the league that need to be figured out. One of those things is pay. Remember, a couple weeks ago, the league and the players agreed to prorated salaries this year for the players based on the number of games that would be called off or postponed or whatever. So players would be making less money over the course of the year, but would still get paid for however many games they ended up playing, whether that be 100 or 81 or whatever it might be. So you have that in mind, but the players are saying they still want to be paid their full salaries for the games they play. If you're making however much money per month, let's say you're making approximately $2 million a month on your current contract, you want to make that money. You want to get paid for those games. The league, according to Jeff Passan, would like to cut salaries further to offset the revenue they've lost by not having a first month plus of the baseball season. And the players counter with, we're already taking prorated salaries. We already had cuts during April and May without games. That's all we're going to do. So there's a labor dispute issue that needs to be figured out somewhere. Although, can you imagine the bad PR for baseball and for the players if they got this close at this time and people got so excited and then they couldn't come to an agreement on pay and it never even got off the ground? That would be a public relations nightmare for baseball, but that's also so far down the line. We don't need to worry a ton about that right now, but it's, again, one of these hurdles that has to be overcome. Then the other thing, government approval. Major League Baseball needs to be in touch with the federal government to make sure it is okay for them to reopen. Then you have the states that need to reopen, and some states have been stricter than others. You've got to deal with international policies, too. You have a team in Toronto. Would the Blue Jays be able to play at the Rogers Center, or would they have to relocate to Florida for the year and play at their spring training site? There are so many things that they need to figure out.
Wasn't this the year that Tampa Bay was supposed to be playing in part in Toronto, or where was it?
Montreal.
Montreal, yeah.
They waved that off, but yeah, that would have been this year too. And God, I'm sure they're happy that that never came to fruition, because that would be an absolute nightmare. But you have all these things you need to figure out. So I get that there is a lot of pushback and a lot of pessimism and kind of just general negativity about, oh, there's so many things to do, this is never going to happen. But if you're looking for a promise that we are actually going to get baseball this year, that we are going to get a season and it's going to happen before too long, this is the best sign yet. This is more than just, well, what if we did this? Or what if we did this? This is Major League Baseball is putting in writing a plan and is planning to give it to the Players Association in the next several days. Assuming that comes to fruition, this is a really big step to getting sports back here in this country. 3:36 here on 580 Sports Talk. Time for our weekly conversation with Matt Verderam, national NFL writer for fansided.com. Check out the Stacking the Box column over at Fansided right now. Tons of information in it this week. But Matt, before we get to the NFL this week, have a couple non-NFL notes we need to get to. And the first of which, our good friend Jake LeBond. He is on paternity leave this week, just welcomed his first child into the world. I know you are a father as well. Do you have any first-time fatherhood advice to give Jake this week?
Soak it in. Enjoy it. Just accept that you're not going to sleep a lot, but that's okay, right? Like, you kind of knew that going in. So congratulations to Jake and his family. I think it's great.
Yeah, definitely happy for him and glad to hear everyone at home is doing well. And we also, Matt, need to get to this before we get to football. I know you're a New York Knicks fan. So last night, The Last Dance, they address the Bulls-Knicks rivalry from the mid-90s. Did you watch the episodes last night on ESPN? And how'd you feel about seeing your Knicks go up against Michael Jordan in retrospect?
Yeah, I did. I did watch. And yeah, I feel like when somebody says I'm a Knicks fan at this point, it's like a personal insult. But yeah, you know what? I thought it was accurate. And, you know, Jordan made the comment about, yeah, they were a tough team, but if we played well, we knew we were much better, and they were. I mean, as a Knicks fan, it pains me to say that, but they were a much better team. So, look, the only part of that that was painful was watching Charles Smith. I can't stand Charles Smith. If I ever saw him, I would have to walk the other direction. I three times. I mean, my God, just go up strong with it once. You're at home. Like, just get a foul call. Do anything. Three different times. Shot block. 6'11". I mean, you just go up with it and force him to foul you. But he didn't, and here we are.
Every single person I know who follows the Knicks or is a Knicks fan or knows New York basketball was saying the exact same thing on Twitter last night. That, man, you got to do something else. You got to do something different if they're going to keep attacking you like that.
I mean, just go up strong with it. If nothing, look, now I'm not sitting here coming from like some basketball expertise background. I played crappy basketball in high school. But, I mean, my God, you're 6'11". Just take the ball with two hands, go straight up, and try to jam it. And you're either going to jam it or you're probably going to get fouled one of those three times. Instead, he was doing all these head fakes, kind of going up, but not really all of his heart into it. I look back and I can live with them losing to the Bulls. Hell, everybody did. But to lose that way with Charles Smith, that was the first year I remember being a Knicks fan. And it was quite an indoctrination.
We're talking to Matt Verderam of Fansided.com. Go check out the Stacking the Box column over at Fansided right now. And Matt, as we jump into the NFL news this week, the biggest news from today, it was announced this morning, Don Shula, the winningest coach in NFL history, dead at the age of 90. For a younger generation of fans who never even really got to experience Don Shula during his career, I mean, he retired just after I was born, before Marco, our producer today, was born. What is the long-term lasting legacy of Don Shula? Obviously, you can look at the record books and say he won more games than anyone, at least for now. But what is the long-term legacy for Shula?
He's an interesting guy because he doesn't get remembered in some the same ways that some of these coaches who had dynasties get remembered. But Shula was really as influential as just about anybody. He didn't do it necessarily in scheme. Like with Landry, you think of the flex defense with Lombardi, some of the different ways, you know, the power run game. But with Shula, you know, I always point to, he was the head of the rules committee for a very long time. And he helped to usher in fact, he was the spearhead of the NFL changing from being a power run game to a game that was more wide open. You know, in 1978, they really changed the rule book. You used to be able to chuck a receiver all the way up until the ball was in the air, no matter how far downfield they were. Shula was a big part of the reason that changed. You only had that 5-yard buffer zone. And so I think, you know, a lot of different things that the NFL did in the last 40 years was based off of things that Shula tried to bring to the table, helped to pound the table for. And I think really, if you want to get the essence of Don Shula, it was his flexibility in the way he coached the team and the style that he played. You know, in 1972, the only undefeated team ever, they had 2,000-yard rushers. I mean, they were a team that didn't even throw the ball 10 times some games. In 1984, he was the first coach to ever have a quarterback throw for 5,000 yards in Dan Marino. So Shula was great at adapting his style of play to the talent he had, maybe the best there ever was to do it.
And we were mentioning this earlier. There are not many coaches who can say they've worked with a quarterback group like Don Shula did. I mean, he works with Johnny Unitas and Bob Greasy, and of course was the coach for the 72 Dolphins. And then you mentioned he coaches Dan Marino too. I mean, that is a resume of quarterbacks coached up there with, maybe it's all alone when you consider the greatness of all of those guys combined. No one really can match up with that.
No, and he played with Otto Graham when he was with the Cleveland Browns in the 50s. So he got to see greatness as a player. as you know, with Graham as a teammate. And then, yeah, you know, the other guy people forget, and maybe somewhat justifiably compared to that group, but is Earl Morrall, who really was the starter for the majority of the games in 1972. And, you know, Shula would repeatedly say that he thought Earl Morrall deserved to be in the Hall of Fame. Now, I don't know that he should have been in the Hall of Fame necessarily, but you can make it argument Earl Morrall is one of the most underrated players in NFL history. You go back and look. He won the MVP award, by the way, in 68 when he was at the Colts. And really, his career would have been viewed a lot differently had Namath not upset them in Super Bowl III. But look, Shula, again, you go and you look at those Dolphin teams, and heck, even a lot of those Colts teams in Baltimore that he had, that he just couldn't get over the hump. Don Shula was an unbelievable coach. I mean, those guys, you know, they coached 10, 15 years, the game kind of passes them by. Shula was the top-tier coach for 30 years. Almost impossible to do.
Matt Verderam of Fansided.com is joining us here on 580 Sports Talk, as it does at the bottom of the 3 o'clock hour every Monday afternoon. Follow him on Twitter at Matt Verderam. And Matt, let's swing over to some Kansas City Chiefs news. It was just after we spoke last week that the news of Bashaud Breeland's arrest in his home state of South Carolina came out, facing 5 misdemeanor charges. And we also found out during this whole thing that he is potentially facing a 4-game suspension for violations of the substance abuse policy. However, because of the new CBA and the much more lax view and treatment for substance abuse, marijuana specifically, that could alter things. Is there a chance that that suspension is reduced or possibly even thrown out due to the new CBA?
It's possible. I don't think anybody knows right now. You know, right after that Breeland thing went down, I reached out to a handful of league sources and was told, first of all, everybody in the league knew that he was facing a 4-game suspension when he hit free agency. So maybe that's part of the reason he did not have the market everybody thought he was going to have. You know, that he was notified, and the Chiefs were notified, player and then club were notified simultaneously at the end of February. So you're talking a couple weeks after the Super Bowl, and if you go and look at his contract, the escalators in that deal in terms of some incentives he's got to reach, the playing time for him to hit is a lot less than it was in 2018. So clearly it's built in with the idea that he was going to get suspended. Now, whether or not he ends up getting that ban, I mean, you're right. You look at the CBA, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the NFL interprets this. There's an argument to be made that the league could say, look, you failed this test. When the league guidelines still stated that you could not do these things that we have found you to do, and they could still try to uphold that suspension. They could also say, you know what, look, we don't test for marijuana at this point anymore. We're not penalizing for it. We're not going to get involved here. We're going to throw that suspension by the wayside. It'll be very, very interesting. But is it possible? Yes. And then as far as the arrest in South Carolina, it's just going to be interesting to see how the league handles it. All those things were misdemeanors. In some states, some of those things would have just been traffic tickets. But I think the one thing that could be a sticking point for the league is the resisting arrest. If he doesn't resist arrest, I don't think any of that stuff is even really in the conversation for him getting suspended. But because that happened, there is video of it, it doesn't mean he necessarily will, but I do think it opens the door for it.
Well, and you mentioned how the potential suspension or the news, the information the team's got could have led to him having a smaller market or a less interested market than he would have otherwise. Because here on the show, we all agreed that he played his way into a decent contract in free agency, and it ends up working out for the Chiefs. Someone who knows their system, we know Spags likes him, it's a good fit there. But I have to imagine it kind of comes back to that uncertainty you were talking about at the beginning there, that teams just don't know how it's going to be interpreted. And because of that, you kind of would rather have someone else be the guinea pig trial case. I assume that's kind of how it went down with other teams shopping around in free agency.
Yeah, I think that's fair to assume. And, you know, again, just talking to some people throughout the league, there was a sense that, look, we know he's getting a 4-game suspension. We don't know how it's going to play out, like you said. And, you know, the Chiefs, like every other club, they were aware. So I think Kansas City looked and said, look, if he is suspended for 4 games, fine. We're probably going to go 3-1 or 4-0 in those games anyway. So we're willing to deal with that. We're not too concerned. Now, of course, didn't know he was going to get arrested in charge of 5 things on the back end here. But I got the sense just from poking around that Breeland is a good player, but you know he's not viewed as a great player. He's never been a Pro Bowl or an All-Pro. So when you have those kinds of things that are looming, you know, teams are going to shy away. Teams are going to go for the more sure thing. And there's a lot, too, to be said for. It's just a very weird year. You forget even the pandemic, but just, you know, it's a new CBA. The cap was expected to explode. I reported at the Combine that there were a handful of different sources who told me, look, you're looking at a $240 million cap next year up from $200. Now, then the pandemic happened. We're going to see how much that affects the cap. Might affect it a ton. But it's a year where, you know, most years, players want to get the biggest deal they can, the longest-term deal possible. A lot of players this year, unless they were getting paid major money, they were the ones who wanted a one-year deal because they want to hit the market again when the cap exploded. So just a lot of factors, and it wound up the Chiefs were able to get him on a one-year deal.
The big signing for the Kansas City Chiefs recently, looking past the flyer taken on former Michigan quarterback Shea Patterson, was on Friday night. They signed Taco Charlton, the former first-round pick from 2017, and we'll get to that draft class here in just a second. But they bring him in. He's never really completely clicked. He's had various issues that have kind of kept him from being a major impact player. But to me, this seems like the most typical Brett Veach deal possible. A former first-round pick, you sign him for essentially nothing, and if it works out, you essentially recreated last year's Emmanuel Ogba. If not, you move on like last year's Darren Lee. This seems like a low-risk, medium-to-high-reward signing for the Chiefs, and one that is exactly in Brett Veach's wheelhouse.
Yeah, I love this move for the Chiefs because, and I wouldn't say that about every team in this regard, but the Chiefs have a great coaching staff, and they are clearly betting that their coaching staff will be able to get more out of Taco Charlton than anybody else has been able to. And I think it's a smart bet. You look at who his coaches are going to be. I mean, Brendan Daly, who's got just umpteen Super Bowl titles at this point, and he's going to be on the line with Frank Clark and with Chris Jones and Alex Okafor. And he's going to have a coordinator in Steve Spagnuolo. Look, if you can't get something out of him, then it's on the player at that point. Then it's just the player just doesn't care, or he's simply just not that good. But I would look at it and argue it this way. Like, everybody freaked out, you know, a couple months ago when Ogba signed with the Dolphins. A lot of Chiefs fans wanted back. He had 5.5 sacks last year before he got hurt. He was having a really nice year. Charlton had 5 sacks last year with the Dolphins on a line where you could make an argument he was the best defensive lineman on the team. Like Kansas City, what is he going to be, a fourth-best defensive lineman, a fifth-best defensive lineman? So, look, I think it's a really smart move. It's a one-year deal. If you're Charlton, you get to reset your value. If you go out and have 8 or 9 sacks, you're going to get paid. I think for Kansas City, that is a great, cheap way to add a guy who's got a lot of talent, who's got something to prove, and it's not going to hurt you in terms of your cap sheet down the road.
Just a couple more minutes with Matt Verderam of Fansided.com here on 580 Sports Talk as we talk all things NFL. And now, Matt, going around the league, I have to ask about that 2017 draft class, because normally it at least seems that most fifth-year options are picked up for first-round picks, whether you have proven yourself or you're still kind of a project, but teams want to keep you around so they have control for a little bit. But so many guys, and guys who seem to make an impact, have not had their options picked up. Today it was Malik Hooker of the Colts. 4 of the top 5 picks from that year had their fifth-year options declined. And for one guy in particular, Mitch Trubisky, it's not really a surprise. But in retrospect, was that just a really bad class overall? Or were maybe the fits just not right that have led to so many first-round picks not having their option years picked up?
Yeah, you know, you look back at that class, and I do think, you know, it's probably a combination, but I blame it more on the bad fits. You look at Trubisky, that was a forced thing. The Bears felt like they needed a quarterback, and the Bears did need a quarterback, but they misevaluated it. I mean, hell, that's one of the best quarterback classes. You're going to see Mahomes, like he's going to be a generational first ballot Hall of Famer, and Deshaun Watson is certainly in the conversation as somebody who should be a Pro Bowler for the next decade, so they just whiffed. Solomon Thomas, I think, is a guy everybody thought was going to be good. It just didn't turn out that way. But then you look at somebody like Corey Davis. The Corey Davis is a decent player, but the Titans panicked and they took a receiver way too high. They shouldn't have taken him at 5. They never should have taken him at 5. It was a huge reach and they did it. If you go back and watch the film of that draft, people at the time when they were on the clock all thought they were going to take Jamal Adams. They should have taken him, by the way. So, you know, and then with Fournette, that's a typical case of a running back going that high. It's just absurd. And I know every once in a while, yes, you're going to get the Ezekiel Elliott. But it was just another example of a team kind of reaching, kind of panicking. I think by and large, most of these fifth-year options being declined weren't too shocking. I mean, Fournette, you can make an argument either way, although it seems like that's an unhappy marriage in Jacksonville. I was surprised that Hooker got his option declined. He can play. He's had injuries, but he's a really good player. And Malik Hooker, when he's on the field, is a difference maker. So that was a little bit of a surprise. Trubisky, I'm not surprised, though. I think all that does is tell you that Nick Foles is starting this year. I don't see any way. You're not going to decline the option. Meanwhile, you've got Foles, who's got 3 years now on this guaranteed deal, and then sit Foles. There's just no way. I mean, Foles, that basically just cemented that he's going to be the starter as long as he's healthy come week one.
One more real quick one for you, Matt. We were discussing this just before you came on the air today. A report from the New York Post that the NFL has brought up with its broadcast partners playing games on Saturdays all fall in case the college football season is called off. Do you think that's a good idea? And it sounds unlikely because it sounds like there will be some kind of college football. But do you think that'd be a smart move business-wise for the NFL?
If there's no college football, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. Then you just corner the entire weekend. I think the NFL figures back with it, right? If we can expand and continue to gobble up more days on the calendar, we'll do it. But I agree. I think it's a long shot. First of all, I do think college football is going to be played in some capacity. And B, I just don't think the NFL's got the appetite for really, really going down the road here with this. They're going to probably, you know, play their normal slate, you know, Sunday, Mondays, Thursdays. The real interesting question to me is, are they going to try and play these games with fans? You had the report today at USA Today that said the Dolphins are looking into social distancing and maybe having 15,000 or so fans at games. Is that something that is going to just be in a couple states, across all states? I'm very fascinated to see how that plays out with the NFL.
Check out the Stacking the Box column over at fansided.com. Matt Verderam writes it every week, does a great job with it, and does a great job with us here, bottom of the 3 o'clock hour, every Monday, talking all things NFL. Make sure you follow Matt's work on Twitter as well, at Matt Verderam. Matt, thank you as always, and enjoy the rest of the week.
Thanks a lot.
It is time for today's What Is Wrong With You? We will decide our weekly champion, the current champ, the best friend car thief. The man was friends with a guy for 20 plus years. Best friends. In their mid-40s. Been friends for forever. Borrowed his car. A $60,000 Jaguar. Then after borrowing it, he pawned it. Then got it back and pawned it again. And then pawned it again. And then eventually he couldn't make payments on it. And he lost the car to the pawn shop. So what did he do? Admit his mistake to his friend? Nope. He just ghosted him. Didn't talk to him. Didn't see him. Didn't interact with him at all. For a whole year, had to call a private investigator to find out what happened. Eventually, he was arrested for Grand Theft Auto. That is a very worthy weekly champion, but two other weekly competitors coming up here as well. See if they can take down the best friend car thief. Marco, we'll go with you first for today's What Is Wrong With You.
All right, we're going to Cape Coral, Florida, where a North Fort Myers man punched a police officer in the face after he refused to pay a $17.54 bill from a Chili's restaurant in Cape Coral. According to the police department down there in Cape Coral, 35-year-old Scott Bolton was arrested. Officers were called to the restaurant around 11 p.m. on Thursday night. It sounds like the suspect tried to sneak out without paying the bill, police said. When the officer tried to arrest him, he started resisting and punched the officer in the face. Bolton then grabbed the officer's taser, trying to take it away, according to police. He continued to resist until other officers got to the scene to help take Bolton into custody. According to police, he also made threats to kill the officers when he gets out of jail. Oh, God, that's even worse. Bolton.
Yeah, can't be doing that, pal.
No, when you're behind bars, I feel like that's the last thing that you should be doing. But he was charged with battery on a law enforcement officer, depriving an officer of means of protection, resisting an officer with violence, making threats to an officer, and criminal mischief and petty theft.
I mean, why are you threatening to kill someone over a bill at Chili's? Like, you're taking it way too far, man. Chili's is not that serious. Also, pay your bill. Like, 35 years old. You should be able, if you're going out to the Chili's, you should be able to pay your less than $18 bill.
Yes, and I will agree that maybe the $17 bill was built up on some alcoholic drinks looking at the guy's mugshot now, but come on, man, $17, even if you're inebriated in some way, that's how are you getting inebriated off 17 bucks? That far inebriated, at least.
Man, that's bad luck. $17.54. Just pay the dang bill, man. Come on. For my story, we are also going to Florida. We're going to Port Orange, Florida, where a man driving with a car that had Florida Gator specialty license plates broke into a seafood store to steal gator tail meat, among other things. 30-year-old James Ellison, who was already suspected in other burglaries, was arrested on Tuesday, charged with two counts of armed burglary by Port Orange police. Ellison, who was previously arrested in a boat burglary case in Volusia County recently, was in jail without bail earlier this week. Now, the Port Orange police say they were called by owners of Port Orange Seafood on April 30th. At the business, police learned that someone had stolen gator tail meat, amberjack meat, tuna steaks, and Alaskan king crab from the store's outside freezers. The police were then able to quickly identify Ellison based on information gathered by the Volusia deputies when they arrested him for the boat burglary in April. Deputies obtained a video showing Ellison's hand that had his daughter's name tattooed on it. Visible tattoos. Not a good idea if you're going to leave them exposed when you rob a place. In the video as well, deputies were able to notice a Hyundai with Gator's license plates. Remember, James Ellison had customized Florida Gator's license plates. Yikes. Police saw the same hand tattoo and specialty license plates in the seafood store's video surveillance. They also got help from Ellison's wife, who confirmed the tattoos and his identity and reported that Ellison had stolen the seafood on several other occasions from the store. She also continued to rat him out, saying that her husband had a penchant for fishing equipment, but had also stolen lawn equipment and firearms. She said some of those things were even in the garage. Others had been pawned off. In the garage, police found fish, crab, amberjack, and gator meat, along with tuna steaks that were all stolen. Knives and fishing reels from another different burglary were also found at the house. Dude was a klepto, okay, or is a klepto. Just loves stealing things. But man, not that I'm ever going to condone robbery and theft, but buddy, wear gloves. It's your hand. You shouldn't be leaving fingerprints anyway. Wear gloves.
Yeah, this
cover up your hand tat.
It reminds me of the pill stealers we had at the Walgreens that were emptying the pills, or what was it? They were throwing out the bottles as they were driving off.
They robbed the pharmacy, then threw the bottles out the window, leaving a trail right back to the house they were at.
I can't decide if this guy is a good robber or just complete dummy, because you know he has some stuff in his garage that he's stolen and he's been able to have some successful runs. This one wins it for me today. There's just so many added on to it, and the fact that you know you're going into this knowing that not knowing where your wife would stand on it as being faithful. She was breaking pretty much the code of marriage there.
Like, how many issues do you have to have at home or with being a kleptomaniac that your wife just says enough is enough, I'm ratting you out for all the meat, all the fish, all the guns, all the lawn furniture that you've stolen over the years?
She essentially put him into the doghouse.
Yeah, she did. She's like, you know what? I'm sick of your you know what. I'm ratting you out to the cops. I'm with you. I think that one wins today. Now the question, though, is, does this beat the best friend car thief? This is close.
It's tough. It really is, because thinking about the 20 years of friendship leading up to it.
I think I'm going with our reigning champion. I think I'm taking the best friend car thief. 20 years of friendship, and you just steal his car and ghost him. What are you doing?
This guy had a history of stealing, though, and he just kept doing it. It's like you said, he has an addiction with it, but yeah, the 20 years of friendship, and it's like I said, got to go with the boss man with his rule, Jake LaBotte, on this one. Homie, what are you doing, man? I understand a wife trying to get rid of her husband, but this is not how you get rid of a friend. This is not it.
That's the winner. A great week for the best friend car thief that will advance on to our monthly tournament at the end of May. That's a couple of really good stories today, though. Dang, that's a tough competition.